Good afternoon. It's Friday, the 20th of January, 2017, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Brian Gerrish. With me in the studio, of course, Mike Robinson. We'll also be joined by live video Skype link by David Scott with Northern Exposure. We're just going to say it's, what is it, Trumpton Day?
Trumpton, yeah.
Trumpton. It's a children's programme, or used to be, or
yes.
Something like that. We wait to see what's going to happen in the States. We were just fascinated to hear the BBC reports, which, of course, were giving voice to the protesters outside of a hotel in New York, I think it was. So BBC giving them a loud, clear voice to express their unhappiness with the inauguration of Mr. Trump. There wasn't any opportunity for the other side to respond, of course, but that's what BBC real unbiased news reporting is all about.
Yes. Right, David, we're going to get straight up north of the border and the National Health Service. And I wanted your comments on this. And I know I'm hijacking you a little bit here, but this is the Press and Journal saying Highland woman told she will have to wait a year just to get on the hospital waiting list. And the key point is here, she's looking for a cataract operation. 15-minute procedure, but she has been told that she has to wait a year, as it says in the headline, just to get on the waiting list. And that means that that's when she starts waiting for the actual operation. So she has to wait for a year in order to wait for another year for the operation. It's not quite that long, probably 18 months, 20 months, something like that, in order to get the operation. Is this normal procedure in Scotland these days that you have to wait to wait?
Yes, it is becoming normal procedure because obviously we monitor the time spent on the waiting list and have to report that politically. And therefore, there's a waiting list for the waiting list so we can keep some of the people off the official waiting list and make the figures look better. This is called bureaucracy and it gets a little messy.
Is this happening broadly across Scotland or is this woman just unlucky about the hospital that she's... belonging to?
It's becoming more and more prevalent. There was questions asked on Thursday in First Minister's Questions where a woman was having to travel 3,000 miles to get treatment in Europe because she could not receive treatment in Scotland. The NHS in Scotland is often trumpeted as a great success for the administration. Here, it's nothing of the sort. There is clearly a rationing by means of delay going on. If you make something free at the point of use, there is a huge tendency for it to be oversubscribed and costs run away, and you're not rationing by price, which is how scarce resources are normally distributed. So there's rationing by other means, and that tends to be delay. And for non-life-threatening conditions, the gradual nature, the glacial nature of progress in the NHS in Scotland is very noticeable.
Okay, thanks for that.
Well, I just wanted to ask a question, David. Do people north of the border recognise that there is a problem with the NHS? Because, of course, our illustrious Prime Minister, Theresa May, says there isn't a problem. And the Minister for Health, Jeremy Hunt, also says there isn't a problem.
There's some recognition, but it's been used as a political football. So the government in place tries to take all the credit for everything that the NHS does, and say, look, you need the state, you need us, because look how much we love you. And the opposition says, no, we could run it much better. You're terrible. It's not a very enlightening debate. Whether people realise is the biggest problem. A few do, but I think that's a message that we need to be communicating from the column and from the conference that you're planning this year, Brian, because there's much to say there.
Well, I thoroughly agree with that. And I will say that this morning I was able to make contact with the National Health Service Party, a party which is setting itself up specifically to fight the case for the NHS. And I've got to say, in about a 20-minute conversation with a lady, she gave me a lot of detail about their thoughts about what's going on. We've been almost swamped with stuff coming in about the NHS. And yes, we think the right way to deal with this is an appropriate conference to expose what's going on. We'll give more details of that very shortly. Well, let's jump to the subject of police. The NHS has got big problems. Well, Theresa May says it hasn't. The police have got big problems. We know it has. Let's have a look at this article from the Mail, complete with a video clip, which people need to go and watch. This is Avon and Somerset police accosting a man in the street. They think he's a wanted man. In fact, he was a man who'd helped them set up their own race relations organisation. It's interesting to watch the domineering action of these two police officers, a very big male who's top left in that picture, and obviously the policewoman you can see with her taser. And they ask him for his name and details. He said, "Why do you want it? I'm not giving it to you." And the two police, in my opinion, then escalate what should be a very simple situation. They pull out. The lady police constable pulls out her taser, and as this man tries to go into the gateway to his own house, it then turns physical, I would say largely as a result of the action of the police, and the policewoman tasers him in the face, and you can have the pleasure of seeing the man on the ground. He said he hit the back of his head very hard because he, as you see, just fell over backwards and hit his head on the curbstone or the or into the gutter, and you can hear the policewoman saying, "You've been tasered."
Yes, there was no warning that she was going to taser him.
No problem.
She tasers him afterwards. The thing that struck me about the article, Brian, was looking at the comments underneath, and probably 70% of the comments underneath the article said, "Well, if the man had just given them his name, there would have been no problem." Well. This demonstrates a complete lack of the constitutional position in this country. There is a presumption of innocence in any common law jurisdiction, and that includes no obligation to identify yourself to anyone, including the police. The police have to demonstrate that there is a possibility, you know, that there is a crime either in progress or has taken place. This man wasn't being arrested for anything. He was being stopped and searched, I presume.
Accosted is the right word,
yes.
Really, Mike.
No obligation to cooperate whatsoever, no legal obligation, no moral obligation. In fact, his duty constitutionally is to uphold his constitutional position, which is his right to remain silent. David, have you got any thoughts on that?
I saw just a little bit of the video via a Scottish newspaper, and I was struck by the fact that the man who was tasered was being the adult in the conversation, and he seemed to be the person who was being lawful. And it's always concerning to see the police, who have got a monopoly of violence in many ways and of weapons, behaving in such a lawless manner.
Sorry, Brian, just before we move on, David, I just wanted to ask, is that in fact Jimmy Cranky holding the taser there?
No, we've got Jimmy Cranky fully employed running our country.
Ah, right. Okay, that explains that. Brian?
Well, I just wanted to add to this one that, of course, if you go online, go to Birmingham Heartlands Hospital, you should be able to download the PDF of the original, the very original safety advice given to police forces about the taser, written by a hospital doctor, who said, well, it's safe apart from the fact it could hit you in the groin, it could hit you in the eye, you might be using a pacemaker. So there was a whole list of bullet points of risks. This man was hit in the face. That's what the article in the paper says. If he'd been hit in his eye, he would have lost an eye. And then the Daily Mail is crowing that the police apparently due to be issued with two-shot tasers. So just in case they don't get you with the first shot, they've got another opportunity. And I will...
63, yeah?
63 or 62.
And so you've got two officers and one's a big burly chap, and we've got a 63-year-old who's not being aggressive and is trying to go into his house.
Yes.
Can there be any possible justification for this? I can't see that there can be.
Well, I'm going to say this is where we and the public really need to pay attention to who has been training the police, because we've seen a massive change in the way the police deal with the general public. Gone are the white shirt days and the helpful Bobby on the beat. We're seeing something very cold, calculating, low empathy. And if you follow the police's training program, that's going to lead you to the National College of Policing, where we are seeing the head woman a psychiatrist. Why should that be? We're seeing the use of NLP. And I know every time I mention NLP, I get people saying it can be used for good. I'm not talking about NLP being used for good. I'm talking about NLP being used for very dangerous political indoctrination and indeed behavior change in order to get these policies through. So I think people need to be looking, one, at police training, and two, also at police recruitment, because I believe, I will present the evidence as soon as I can compile it, so I'll say I believe at the moment, but what we're watching is the police use selective psychometric tests to select low empathy people to become police officers.
So if that is true, Brian, and we need to put this in the context of the report that we had last week or the week before about the Metropolitan Police consulting on routinely armed police in this country. And in the context of this report, that's got to be a dangerous situation.
Yeah, so you desensitise, you reframe your own police force to make them think that the public is an enemy, and then you consult that police force on whether they should be armed.
Yes, well, it's not just in Britain that, that we have problems with the police. David, what's happening here? What is the police lion?
This is a video that everyone should watch. It's truly horrendous. It's from Finland, and it's a very jolly video by way of a TV advert.
But the music, the music is particularly jolly and uplifting.
It's very yes, and we've got this lion here, and it's there to advise children and the public in general how they should behave, and it then cuts to a scene where the child is sitting next to her mother, and her mother's sending a message via social media to a politician, and it's a strongly worded message. The child then says, "Well, why don't you say that to his face?" "Oh," says the mother, "I would never say that to someone's face." And the child then reports to a small toy version of the police lion, which then becomes a full-size version in a suit, as you see here. And the child and the police lion tell off the mother, who admits her wrongdoing and promises never to do it again. And the message is, don't say anything nasty or unpleasant on social media. Don't criticise your politicians, because it's like a tattoo, it's there forever. And the message is also clearly and very sinisterly that children should report on their parents to the authorities. And where have we heard that one before?
In states with absolutely no human rights records is the answer. I'll just add, of course, in Devon, and I know this has happened in other places across the country, the police have been using children in order to work with them to stop motorists for speeding. So when the car's pulled over, it's a child who approaches the driver and asks the question. This is very, very nasty and dangerous reframing of the children and politicisation of the children. Where does it lead? Well, I think I can add to that. I watched a video on YouTube a little while ago, a haunting video. It was Germans talking about what was going on at the very end of the Second World War. And the particular this particular aspect was a small group of Hitler youth. They were only just 16, arriving in a village and telling the villagers German villagers what they should do, whereupon the elders stopped these boys. 2 days later, they came back with their adult SS colleagues and hanged three of the men who'd stopped them doing their duty. That's where it ends.
Yes. Okay. David, Airdrie Savings Bank, the end. If we look at, there were a number of mainstream headlines on this. This is the Sunday Herald saying, "Black day for Scottish banking with Airdrie Savings Bank to close and 40 Clydesdale Bank branches to shut." Some people would say, it's a bank, who cares? But it's not quite as simple as that.
It's not. And the Airdrie Savings Bank and the Clydesdale Bank are quite different organisations. I'm from Airdrie. I was born and brought up in Airdrie. And my earliest memory of banking is saving up threepenny bits, brass threepenny bits, and that gives you an idea of age, into a large jar and taking them down to the Airdrie Savings Bank, where they would then take them and put them into an account. The Airdrie Savings Bank was founded in 1835. It was part of the thrift movement that was sweeping all across the United Kingdom. And it was run very conservatively, and it was a means of savings for the local community. It was run by trustees. It was a mutual organisation. The trustees worked for nothing. There were no fat cats. There were no shareholders. And that sort of organisation, you would think, would be the sort of thing we would turn to. But in fact, it's been forced out. And the principal reason, and the reason stated by the bank itself for being forced out of business, is government regulation. Because after the 2008 crash, the regulation is now so onerous that small banks cannot survive. They cannot actually cope with the regulatory burden. So what has regulation done? It has eliminated competition for the fat cat bankers. And that, I would suggest, was always and is always the result.
Okay, so Alex Neil, who's Airdrie and Shott's MSP, said after the financial crash of 2008, it was probably for a while one of the few viable banks left in Britain.
However, only viable banks, I would suggest.
Yes. However, the consequences of the financial crash have meant that it has become impossible for such a small bank as the ASB to survive, particularly given the very tight regulatory regime that now exists for banks in Britain. Now, of course, the most well-known savings bank of trustee savings bank of that type is the Trustee Savings Bank, or was the TSB, and that of course has now been rolled into Lloyds and almost destroyed as a result of the shenanigans leading up to 2008. What is the prospect for this? Are they just closing it, or are they selling it, or what's happening with it?
It's just been closed down. People are told, I mean, there's no financial crisis. There's no difficulty getting your money, because in fact it's extremely sound. It remains the soundest bank in Britain, but they can't see a future. They can't see a future in this environment. So I'm a customer, and we're told that we'll be closing round about the end of April. And just transfer your funds out, and the TSB actually will pick up any outstanding loans, and they'll close the doors, and it will presumably become a bistro or a bar.
Right. So you're saying that you said to me earlier that union officials have said that this bank has become the victim of casino bankers?
Yes, this was the explanation, that the casino bankers have caused this bank to go down. And that's obviously not really the whole case, because the casino bankers wrecked their own banks. The government then bailed out the casino bankers. The government then used taxpayers' money to refloat the casino bankers. So that has several effects. It means that we're subsidizing the casino bankers. We're subsidizing risky behavior. So we're going to get more of it. And it means that actually very careful banking and saving and assembling real assets are no longer able to compete. They can't compete against an environment where you can take wild risks and the government bails you out if you lose. How could a sensibly run organisation possibly compete with that?
And you wanted to highlight Brian Suter website, and this is from 2010, I think, and the headline is, or the title of the article is, Brian Suter and Top Business Names Support Expansion of Scotland's Last Independent Bank.
Yes, they put in £10 million. Suter and a bunch of other businessmen put in £10 million. They just deposited £10 million. I mean, they didn't invest. There was no debt on the Airdrie Savings Bank at all. It had no debt. So they deposited extra money, and they thought that in the wake of the financial crisis, the fact that you had a mutual organisation with zero fat cats, tightly run, based on thrift, 182 years old. It was founded in 1835, January 1835, would actually be something that we could build on, because it was an entirely different banking model based on saving, based on real saving. Now, what the bank did with those real savings is they did lend out, but only to a very modest degree. They had they were by no means fully loaned up the way a high street bank would be. They were very conservative with the lending, and the excess funds they deposited with other banks, or they bought Treasury, United Kingdom gilts, government debt. So very liquid, very safe, interest-bearing assets. And then the profits for that became the interest payments for the depositors. Now, since getting interest is in fact the core of that, what has really killed them is zero interest rate policy. Because what do you get now on government debt? What do you get on a bank deposit? You get zero. So their low-risk strategy, looking for a return with minimum risk and being very careful with your depositors' money, no longer makes any sense in a world where if you want a return, you have to chase risk. This next diagram here is interest rates over time. So you see this sort of general run of UK interest rates, and this, in fact, world interest rates, because this goes back a long, long way, is around 4 or 5%. So what are we now? Base rates 0.25%. It's absolutely without precedence, and it completely skews the entire financial system.
And what's interesting about that graph is that the last time interest rates were as low as they are was for a short period in the early 1930s, but we have had interest rates at this level for a lot longer than even that period of time. So what's that telling us about our current financial and economic position?
Well, interest rates at 0.25% are without precedence, and you're not basing this on anything rational anymore. It's based on PhD standard. It's based on the conversations at Davos. It's not based on economics. It's not based on reality. It's not based on how people interact with one another and the fact that they would prefer to have resources now, but they're prepared to defer them and lend them to someone else, but for, you know, an interest rate of historically something like 5%. Now, the one of the other issues, of course, is that the biggest government subsidy of the banking industry is the guarantee, the loan deposit guarantee. Now, this is a virtual guarantee because if a big bank goes down, there's no way the government's ever paying it. But in theory, and what they tell the people is, you can have £85,000, €100,000 in a British bank, and if anything happens to that bank, the government will make you whole. Therefore, for anyone that has up to that amount, there's really no incentive to be careful about which bank you put your money in. There won't be any bank runs. The Bank of England will bail them out. There won't be any problems. The government, the taxpayer, will bail them out. So having an organisation like the Airdrie Savings Bank, which was actually run very conservatively and very safely, is not an advantage when the taxpayer is subsidising the risky behaviour of the competition.
Yes, well, I'll believe that. If that ever needs to be called upon, I'll believe it when I see it. But anyway, you mentioned Davos a couple of times there, because, I mean, it's not all bad news in the banking sector, because you'll be delighted to know, as I am, as you can imagine, that London Clearing is safe from Brexit. We're not going to be shipping out the City of London from the City of London into Paris and Hong Kong and all these other places. So City of London is safe. We don't need to worry too much about that. But also with Davos, you wanted to highlight this article, and the headline is Davos elites, more control of us by them will pacify rebellious middle class.
Yes, there's several interesting things here. The elites sitting down at Davos have been clearly thrown by Brexit and by Trump and by the general populism and the fact that people aren't really buying it anymore and are clearly unhappy. Now, the core of the unhappiness, the economic core of the unhappiness, you can trace back to, you know, 1971, coming off the gold standard, being on a fiat paper money standard, being on a PhD economist standard, and the fact that nothing is really real, and we've screwed interest rates to the floor, which is assaulting savers, is subsidising borrowers, it's subsidising all the wrong sorts of behaviour, and it means that the entire system, because if the price of money is skewed and artificial, the entire system is skewed and artificial, and you're seeing the unequal distribution of the productivity gains from the advances in technology can be traced back to 1971. The point at which it was necessary to be a fat cat to benefit was the point at which the fat cats got control of the money, as opposed to it being anchored to something that they couldn't control, like the amount of gold in the world. The other aspect of this is they only have one answer. They have one answer, which is theft. Right? We're going to tax people and we're going to redistribute more of the funds, and that'll make them happy. But what they're ignoring there is the people who are unhappy are the people who are paying tax. It's not the few rich at the top that are going to be taxed, although that's what you're meant to take away from that sort of statement. It's the vast majority of the middle class, because that's where the money comes from.
Absolutely. Well, of course, the other big message from Davos, from Theresa May's speech, and actually since Theresa May began talking about exactly the issues you've been mentioning there, has been that Britain is turning into a global power again. Of course, it's not just hard power, it's soft power. And here's another aspect of it, because this is the Magna Carta Fund for Human Rights. Now, there's an oxymoron, if there is, ever was one. Human Rights, the Magna Carta Fund for Human Rights and Democracy. This is bids being invited from Russia. We're pleased to announce, the government says, that the Magna Carta Fund for Human Rights and Democracy now invites proposals for project bids for 2016-17 from Russia only. The Magna Carta Fund for Human Rights and Democracy is the Foreign Office dedicated strategic fund supporting our global human rights and democracy work. Through targeted projects, it aims to further British interests overseas by tackling the root causes of human rights violations, strengthening institutions and governance, supporting the promotion and protection of human rights, and promoting democracy and the rule of law. So the 2016-2017 programme is going to target these particular areas: democratic values and the rule of law. So they're going to uphold universal rights, apparently, democracy and rule of law as key building blocks for more security and prosperous societies. And remember, these are projects that are being run inside Russia. So this is exactly the NGO complex that Putin was warning about. The second key thematic area is the rules-based international order, David. That's fantastic. We're going to support projects that are supporting the rules-based international order. And the final one is human rights for a stable world, because that's going to promote a more stable world by upholding universal rights and tackling conflict and extremism. So there you go. We're pumping a pile of money in through the Foreign Office to these projects, and we're going to transform Russia.
This is a very interesting document. This is an area that I hope that the column will be coming to in detail in weeks and months to come. Democratic values versus rule of law. Democratic values are in conflict with the rule of law, because the rule of law says that law applies to everybody, including the rulers, where democratic values is essentially without restraint, majority rules. So in fact, that is not one and the same thing, either or, as suggested by the UK government, but actually ideas which are in conflict with one another. Rules-based international order, yes. This is what is being wrongly called free trade. It's very heavily regulated trade, and the key question, obviously, is who makes the rules? And as for human rights, the whole issue of rights is something that I would like to come back to with you, because we are being told a lot of lies about rights, and we're being told that things which people want or might aspire to should be treated as rights, when they should be treated as no such thing, because with rights come duties. And by talking about rights, what they're actually saying is we are going to impose duties upon you.
That's absolutely right. And that was another key point of Theresa May's speech in Davos, as we mentioned a couple of days ago. And of course, duties isn't the word that's used, it's obligations. And that's significant as well. Right, David, let's get back up north of the border. Is this a simple case of fraud and corruption?
This man here got unelected, right? He was the man who stood up in Parliament. And when asked about the named person scheme, a Conservative member stood up and asked him what the definition of well-being was. And of course, they don't have one. And he told that Conservative member of Parliament that he was basically the scum of the earth for asking that question. Because you're not meant to ask awkward questions in the New Scotland. He was a diehard supporter of named person and lost his seat, sadly, at the last election. But don't worry, after £60,000 payoff as a kind of compensation prize for becoming unemployed, he's now got a cushy job. It's courtesy of the SNP as a spin doctor. So it's okay. He's going to survive. He won't be on the streets. I know you were worried.
Desperately worried. We were obviously talking about the transformation of the police earlier and the implications of that. This is the civil service logo, of course. Apparently the civil service is going to get thousands of new apprentices and they are going to transform the public sector. So this is the skills minister, Robert Halfen. There he is. He has announced that the Department for Education is setting the public sector a target of 200,000 more apprentices by 2020. Now, of course, at the other end of the educational spectrum, you've got the Fast Track scheme, which brings in graduates. These are going to be 16, 17, 18-year-olds, I guess, that are going to come in at the lower end of the civil service. This is the key point, though. They're going to get the full gamut of civil service training, including leadership training.
These are big society. These are the change agents. These are groomed youngsters. They won't have any experience. They'll be groomed into what the government wants. And, of course, Eric Pickles, David Cameron, we're talking about hundreds of thousands of these youngsters coming in to help run government. That's what big society is about.
And that's the danger, because these when they're basically young adults, children, they haven't had a chance to develop, discover their own minds yet, and
to be wise enough to know how things should work.
Right.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to transform government, you need a good propaganda machine running. And let's remember that our very own BBC has set itself up to run a reality check, to check what everybody else is saying. So this is just a little article from our local Plymouth Herald. It says that a Plymouth pub owner has been fined for not having a TV licence. I think it cost her about £649. But Richard Chapman, the TV licensing spokesperson for the South West, said, "We appreciate these are tough times for businesses, but to be fair to the majority who do pay the licence fee, we have to take action against those who watch TV illegally." Now, remember, the licence fee is collected by Capita. They do it for profit. I think their profit a couple of years ago was about £120 million. So they're doing nicely. But let's just remind ourselves what the BBC is really doing, using taxpayers' money through their proxy charity, BBC Media Action, to put together the programme for the EU to advertise itself. So here we are, a handbook for journalists. This is the book saying to journalists, these are the sources to go to for the facts on the European Union. Help us to spread those facts across Europe and into the new states that the EU is taking on board. So complete and utter hypocrisy from the BBC, a politically active charity. What a dirty organisation overall. Well, we got this little email today, and I'm going to say this is good news because it shows what a bit of attention, some curiosity and analysis can deliver. And so Daryl said, "Dear Brian, the BBC article shows an attempt at
acclimating."
Thank you. I can't see it from this distance, yeah. Mike, I have to admit.
Do you want me to read it?
Yes, go on, okay, do that for me.
The BBC article shows an attempt at acclimating schools to seeing the army in their lives. A chemical in schools used in A-level chemistry was deemed as potentially dangerous. Government instructed its destruction by bomb disposal units, even though there were other methods to rid schools of it. Controlled explosions were then set off. What's that about? Terrorising children, training bomb disposal units, getting the population to see the army as a normal part of a person's day. The army recently been called out with the storm surge threat last week and the ex-squaddies being trained up as teachers. Quite disturbing actions by the state.
Right, so somebody had seen that going on. They were kind enough to send the email in. So I took a look this morning. Well, here's the article. Bomb teams sent to schools 600 times in chemical alert. Bomb disposal teams called out to almost 600 schools in the wake of government advice about potentially hazardous chemicals. Controlled explosions were carried out at some schools. Ministry of Defence released the figures to the BBC under Freedom of Information. Department of Education said it worked with the army for necessary disposals, and the whole thing cost about £90,000. That doesn't seem much to me if you had 600 call-outs. We went looking for an organisation mentioned in the article, CLIAPS, an advisory service providing support in science and technology for a consortium of local authorities and their schools. They were named as providing advice to the schools about these chemicals and the risks. And you can have a look at their website. It's very interesting because they're also promoting that they help schools set up science experiments. We seem to have something pretty hot floating in the air here. But it says that CLIAP's advice and documentation is recognised by the Health and Safety Executive and the Department for Education. So we phoned up this organisation and simply asked what was the advice they gave that then led to bomb disposal. They wouldn't talk to me. They said I had to speak to the media team for the Department of Education, and we'll come on to that. But this is the chemical, 2,4-DMP. Schools who hold stocks of it are reminded to check the storage arrangement for this chemical as per hazard card 30. So this is the advice actually given out by this organisation. It says, please do not call the police until you've called the CLIAP's helpline for further advice. Well, when we went looking for who had originated the advice, it appears it's the Education Funding Agency. And this was the notice they sent out saying that they'd like to remind schools and post 16 institutions of the importance of ensuring these chemicals. And they said specific advice can be found on the CLIAP's website. So stay with me because you'll see where this leads. So we were a bit confused. Who's the Education Funding Agency? Well, this is their website. It is actually a government website, but it says it's a funding agency.
Yeah, so it's an executive agency. So being an executive agency, it's constitutionally separate for government, but it is government, but it's not government.
And it is separate.
And it has a sort of commercial type of legal structure with a chief executive and whatnot, like all executive agencies.
Indeed. So I hope we've our viewers and listeners are still with us on this. So bring in the Education Funding Agency. And you can see on the internet, it's identified as an educational consultancy based in Coventry, England. Then we found this, data.gov. And this is quite interesting because it's actually saying that this is part of the Education Funding Agency, but it's also about change. I encourage you to have a look at this website. So we've got those three and we've got the original organisation. So now we can ask the questions. We originally have government that was running education for our education authorities. They've gone. Now we have, excuse my French, a dog's breakfast of organisations. And who actually gave the advice that resulted in the 600 bomb squad incidents? So if we come back to the article, it said a government spokesperson said we contacted schools. But when we phone them up and ask who that actually was, nobody wants to talk to us. So this is the real question. What is this BBC story really about? Is it dangerous chemicals in school? Is it bomb disposal? Is it waste of public money? Or is it the responsibilities and accountability and public safety? Why would CLIAPS as an organisation not answer any questions? Why does the Department of Education pay to answer the media calls of a private organisation? They wouldn't answer that. And who suggested that schools should call the bomb squad? And why was everyone so jittery? These people were unbelievably jittery when I spoke to them. And then we found this, which is that the CLIAPS helpline is only available to particular schools who are part of their membership. So what happened to the advice for schools who are not part of this membership? It's clear, isn't it?
Yes.
It is clear. So we're going to say what's really going on here is that this is the hollowing out of government by the transformation and change agenda, giving power to unaccountable agencies, private companies and associations. And just as to prove the point, this is a reply I got from the Department of Education, but it just says that we contacted schools to remind them of the importance of storing chemicals for political science activities carefully. We've been working with the armed forces and the police to support schools. What does that mean? And they say the background, it's important that schools and colleges store chemicals in a practical and safe way. So what was really going on in this BBC article? Was it to hype up a scare story about Bum Squad? Or have we got a problem with chemicals in schools? They didn't investigate that. David, what do you make of it?
I doubt that it's a real problem because it's not manifest itself as a real problem. I don't remember anything being reported that it had caused any difficulties. The hollowing out point is very good because we started off talking about the NHS in Scotland. And what we're seeing is we're paying more and more as a people. I mean, we're very heavily taxed and all the rest of it. And we're busy borrowing against the working output of our children and grandchildren. So we're paying more and more, but we're getting less and less for it. Eventually, presumably, the idea is we'll pay everything and get nothing. But we're paying more for the NHS. And the standard of care is not a patch on what it used to be. So GP services have changed out of all recognition, but it costs more. And we're seeing that in schools. We're paying more and more for schools, universities, and the standard of education. The standard of education is falling, and you see that in the raw material that people like the civil servants have, who will believe anything.
Absolutely. Now, at the heart of our problems, perhaps, is our constitution, or at least the lack of recognition of it. This is an independent article. It's written by a lady called Mary Dajewski, who is apparently a leading British commentator on international affairs. And particularly in Russia. She was a former Moscow correspondent for The Times and writes a weekly column in The Independent. So this is clearly somebody that is well clued up on the British Constitution, and that's why she's qualified to write an article on the British Constitution. Just her education, by the way, is a degree from Cambridge, where she studied modern languages. So clearly a good legal foundation there, and she also was an exchange student with the British Council. So anyway, what she's saying in this article, the article's headline, the Brexit Supreme Court row shows that we should be paying closer attention to our constitution. And she says many criticisms have been made of the workings of US democracy, from voter registration to the gerrymandering of constituencies to the role of money, and as seen in 2000, the actual mechanics of voting and counting. Much harder to fault is the Constitution, which underpins the US democracy. The US Constitution is brief, to the point, and practical, written more than two centuries ago. It has held up well, so well that many of us journalists covering the aftermath of the tied 2000 election took to carrying around a copy to find out what was supposed to happen next. In the UK, we have prided ourselves on our unwritten Constitution, made up of a body of legislation passed and amended over centuries. The idea that it is continually evolving to suit new circumstances is regarded as a strength. And this is the first big mistake that she makes here, of course, because the Constitution isn't continually evolving to suit new circumstances. The same principles historically have been expressed in modern language as time has passed, but at the heart of it has been the same principles. So it hasn't evolved into something different. It is simply a restatement of earlier principles. And the fact that it is an ancient constitution is one of its strengths, not a weaknesses. She goes on to say, as is the way the public has accepted an arrangement in which rights, responsibilities and the limits of administrative power are scattered around many laws, if they're written down at all, rather than measurable against a single document, such as a constitution or basic law that sets the yardstick. We, as you said earlier, David, we've got this comment again of rights and responsibilities, and this notion of responsibilities, which you only get the rights if you maintain the responsibilities, is something which is part of the constitutional reform agenda. It's not something which is part of the British Constitution historically. And she goes on to say, increasingly, though, this prime source of national pride has been looking, if not obsolete, then inadequate in the modern world. And so it goes on. And David, there is just a basically fundamental lack of appreciation of the British Constitution and what it actually gives us.
As she defines the modern world, which seems to be a descent into tyranny, I would say the British Constitution is entirely out of date and anachronistic because it stands for liberty.
Well,
and the United States Constitution, right, which is a highly questionable document and not nearly what it's cracked up to be, is ultimately interpreted by five people, because if you have five Supreme Court justices, you have a majority. And they are determining that or reinterpreting the words of that constitution in a way which makes black white, and they're doing so frequently. So, yes, I love our allegedly unwritten constitution, and we need to learn much more about it.
Absolutely. Any thoughts?
Well, only to agree and say that that is the objective of the British Constitution Group, and, of course, another event coming up in the next couple of months with the objective of bringing as many people together to be doing work in this area and, of course, in other areas such as the Bradbury Pound.
Okay. This morning, the historical investigation into child abuse in Northern Ireland reported doesn't seem to have had the same issues with resignations and so on as in Scotland or in England and Wales. What was said? Sir Anthony Hart was the retired High Court judge that ran the inquiry. He took evidence from all kinds of people, and he decided that the main problem lies with the church and charities in Northern Ireland, where widespread abuse and mistreatment of young residents in various children's home in Northern Ireland was rife. He said that there was sexual abuse carried out by priests and lay people. The largest number of complaints related to four Catholic-run homes. And he said those were related to Sisters of Nazareth homes. What did he say about Kinkora? Because, of course, the Kinkora Boys' Home in East Belfast was the main sort of at the heart of this whole thing because of the allegations of government complicity, that there was a child abuse ring, a paedophile ring taking place there, and that MI6 and MI5 were complicit in it. Well, he said that there was no evidence that Kinkora was used as a homosexual brothel by the security services as a honeypot, and that there was no credible evidence to support any of the allegations. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that there was no child abuse happening at Kinkora. There was, and there have been people prosecuted for it. The issue here was whether there was a systematic ring being run, and certainly, if not, being directly run by the security service, being permitted by the security services because they were able to use it as a source of blackmail and other things. But no evidence for that, Brian.
I think that's appropriate. We'll just follow on through. We'll give David a chance to come in here as well. But this is the Daily Mail. This is a particularly harrowing article. People need to read it because it's about reality. It's saying a former child sex slave was sold into Belgian aristocratic paedophile ring where boys and girls were tortured and killed. And the article goes into some detail. Now, we've subcaptioned it with Belgium, Holland or Germany. For example, child abuse seems to go on everywhere, but not amongst British members of Parliament and the British establishment. So you can forget that. And then I've chosen the Croydon Advertiser here, but there's been quite a bit in the press recently about Shirley Oaks, which is going to cost the local council millions because of the children abused. We have been told that the Met Police are aware of 24 child murders in connection with Shirley Oaks. We're also told that there is a big effort to keep this fact out of the mainstream media. We are not at all surprised because the usual course of action for the police is denial, no proper investigation, and then they can say there's no crime. They've done that in Beechwood, Nottingham. They've done it with the missing 324 Syrian children. They did it with Oxford and Cherwell Valley College, North Wales Boys' Homes, Jana, Britain, Cyril Smith, you name it. David, it's just apparent that this stuff is real. It isn't just the sexual abuse of children. They're being used for films. They're being tortured. They're being murdered. And yet our police seem remarkably shy of doing any investigation. Why should that be?
Well, It's such a pattern, and it's such a sad and predictable outcome that we can find government inquiries will find anybody guilty but the government. We're fine, but you know these other organisations are not. The piece by the Belgian lady, Ms. Lucas, she is extremely brave. She describes the number of scars she has on her body from everything she went through as a child. It's very moving, but it's something that I would heartily recommend people watch because it does bring home the reality of the situation. And as far as there's insufficient evidence, if we've heard that particular cry once, we've heard it 1,000 times, and yet you take even one or two of the witnesses who have gone public from Kinkora, and they're extremely convincing, and their testimony is evidence, and it just doesn't seem to tally with the constant reassurance we get that really there's nothing to see. I don't think many people buy that story anymore.
Well, I'll just say once again, David, of course, unlike the Scottish inquiry and the England and Wales inquiry, the Northern Ireland inquiry didn't seem to have the same problem with resignations. So that one seemed to run very smoothly, and there was nobody involved in that seems to have questioned the way that it was being run. Perhaps there's a clue there.
Mm. Yes, and the only inquiry that's actually been run with any sort of openness is the Royal Commission in Australia. And why we haven't had something similar here with public hearings and daily press reports and a full and thorough opening up of the problem, well, I think I know why, but it's a great pity that we haven't had that sort of inquiry. The sort of thing that 150 years ago this country used to do rather well.
Yes.
Okay, that brings us to the end of today's news. David, thank you very much for joining us. Thank you also to those individuals in the BBC who we understand are now watching the UK column, hoping for scraps of fake news. I don't think you're going to find it. So we wait for the BBC to really report on child abuse. Pigs may fly. Thank you very much to our supporters. We do need more subscribers. If you're not a subscriber yet, please consider doing that. And or making us a donation. We can only do what we do with your support. And I'll also say that many people have been asking us what the latest is with the Doherty family. We've had very difficult communications with the Dohertys, which has caused mainly that has stopped our reporting. But what we are going to aim to do is to give a report on the Dohertys as part of the news this coming Friday. So join us then, and we will bring you up to date with the situation as we know it. Thanks very much for joining us. Have a good weekend. We'll be back on Monday. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.